Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, Earth Explorers, from all around, off and inside the planet, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. My AccuWindow forecast is about 48 degrees in western North Carolina. Lots of stars out tonight. Great stargazing state here in North Carolina. Remember, if you'd like to be a part of tonight's program, you can always call in anywhere off planet, 530-413-4511. East of Earth is 530-413-4515. West of Earth, 530-413-4520. And if you want to listen by cell phone, you can easily do this by 712-432-0075 and put in the access code 318-116-pound. The solar wind is a very, very mild 283 kilometers per second. That's the lowest that I've seen it this year. And the proton count is down to 0.7 protons per cubic centimeter. You would think that the sun would be nice and quiet, but active sunspot 1121 has unleashed one of the brightest X-ray solar flares in years. An M5.4 class eruption at 1536 UT on November 6th, that was yesterday. Radiation from the flare created a wave of ionization in Earth's upper atmosphere that alerted the propagation of low-frequency radio waves. I'm sorry, altered the propagation of low-frequency radio waves, like AM. There was, however, no bright CME hurled in our direction, so the event is unlikely to produce auroras in the nights ahead. This is the third M flare in as many days from this increasingly active sunspot. We could see a lot from it tomorrow as well. So far, however, none of the eruptions have been squarely Earth-directed, but this could change in the days ahead as the sun's rotation turns the active region toward our planet. Doesn't bode well for me. I will be flying to Egypt tomorrow and then on to China. I don't want to be at 40,000 feet should there be strong X-rays coming in from the sun. NASA has announced a big delay in Space Shuttle Discovery's launch last flight. The next possible launch opportunity comes on November 30th. That's a ways away at 4:05 a.m. The cause of the delay is twofold, a persistent hydrogen leak and a possible crack in the shuttle's external tank foam. We've had unfortunate experience with that before. Don't take any shortcuts, guys, just because it's the last flight. Go out in style and then mothball that spacecraft and keep it ready to go, because you never know when you're going to need it. China has also pulled off a breathtaking economic transformation. Those of you that have been watching the news, TV, or are involved in any kind of import-export business surely know that. China will soon become the mightiest economic power in the world. It will challenge American hegemony as never before in modern times. When the Chinese talk about instability, they mean civil war, chaos, and mass starvation under Mao. They mean tens of millions dying as their rulers fight for power. 8 million people leave their homes in rural areas every year and travel to the cities to find work. We went through that ourselves in our country, ending up as migrant workers in China, living in foul dormitories, seeing their wives and children perhaps once a year. So China is rapidly replaying our history in the 20s and 30s as people left the farms and headed for the cities to find work. Cities couldn't adapt fast enough. Money couldn't be printed fast enough, accounted for fast enough, banked fast enough. People weren't really spending it on anything real, that is to say real property. And there became a glut of cash. And in the 50s, our economy boomed. And that's exactly what China's going through right now. We'll keep you posted a little bit more on this. It's a different culture than here. When you go to a factory in China, they line up at the beginning of the shift for roll call in very much military style. Rows and rows of people all wearing the same uniforms. It's very regimented still. However, intelligent, hardworking, and well-educated people, the Asians all are, and they see the TV as well as anyone else does, and they realize that those kinds of mores, those kinds of methods of managing the sociology aren't effective anymore, and that may be the challenge of the century. We'll see how that unfolds. There were 25 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with only two measuring over 5.0. The Earth is quiet, with the exception of the Java Island volcano. Nearly 2 weeks after Merapi's first deadly release of ash on October 26th, Indonesia continues today to struggle with the humanitarian fallout from the disaster. More than 135 people have been killed in a series of increasingly intense eruptions, according to the National Disaster Management Agency, almost 100 of them since a massive eruption on Friday launched superheated clouds of gas and debris that literally incinerated people, animals, and homes. Our hearts go out to them. It is an unfortunate matchup when living things go up against something as unpredictable and almost unimaginably powerful thing as a volcano. Hey, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, my latest book achieved the rank of number 4 in spiritual, motivational, and number 9 in the genre of self-help on Amazon, so we're proud of that, happy about it anyway. The overall rank, with more than 9 million books currently listed, reached 204, which is not too bad. If you missed the offer on Coast to Coast, that's okay, because you listen to X Squared Radio. Unless you want to be an alternate, however, there is no room on the Egypt trip. You can, however, still get your autographed copy of the book, along with the audio version for free, by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. The special offered was you get the paperback, and if you buy the paperback, you get it autographed, and you get the audio version of the book free as a download with your PayPal receipt. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. As you prepare for the coming events, and you can see them on several different aspects or planes of our existence, economic, social, and even geological, you may want to get prepared by getting a hold of 1-800-PREPARE.com. My friend Paul Faust and his EMT partner, right after 9/11, put together this website and have built it as a passion. It provides you easy access, easy pricing, easy shipping. And they package the right things together, so it doesn't take you but maybe 2 or 3 clicks, and you've got the basics to take care of you and yours, be they your family or friends, roommates or whatever, co-workers, in case of an emergency. And the emergency could be in the form of weather or utility outage or conflict. And we never hope that those things happen, but when they do, it's nice to be prepared so that you, being empowered with advanced knowledge and the ability to prepare for it, are not a burden upon the emergency preparedness personnel. Also, those of you that have purchased the book, we greatly appreciate your patronage. There is an audio CD that goes with the book that is a learning aid as you try to learn the Flower of Life meditation. Please visit MaureenSaintGermain.com or click on the Merkaba 2 CD link at either of the websites, X2RadioScience.com or RememberingTheFutureBook.com. Also, many of you might have seen the movie Twilight. Yes, I hear the rousing applause out there. I was just waiting for it to die down. The producer of Twilight has contacted me and wants me to write a screenplay for the Ark of Millions of Years series. That is being done as we speak. And hopefully by the time I get back from China, it will be ready. And we'll send it off to him and see if we can't get that started. So you might be able to see the union of the polarity on the big screen before you know it. Coming up in November 11, 2011, the Pythagoras Conference is the first Midwestern Central Conference of its kind, 20 speakers, workshops, and a superb chance to network in the emerging science and paranormal community without having to fly to the West Coast or to Las Vegas. There have been conferences before in this region, kind of small, but nothing of this size and with the resources that this one will have. 73% of the U.S. is within driving distance of this conference, so it's affordable. And I guarantee that if you have never been to a conference like this, that you will be amazed and you will be enlightened and you will like it. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X2RD Radio. This is a short 30-minute version of the program. And the more you click and the more your friends click there, the better our chances are of syndication. And that means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word, because we need something positive going on out there. There's a lot of doom and gloom, and we don't want that to spread too far. My guest tonight almost needs no introduction. If you like archaeology, if you like paleo anthropology, there are few that don't know his name. He is the author of Forbidden Archaeology, De-Evolution, and now a new book, which is a compilation of his columns in Atlantis Rising magazine. Michael Cremo is with us, and we will be back with him in about 40 seconds, so don't go away. X2RD Radio is coming at you. 40 seconds.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. Space travel.
You remember going to school, you saw the ape and Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon and blah, 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 all the way up to your zoology teacher, and then finally humans. And you believed that story, that we crawled forth from the primordial ooze and gradually got smarter and stronger and faster. But there's another story out there, and the evidence bears it out. And there's one man who has been digging it up and putting it together and very carefully and very scientifically putting it out there to the world on an official basis in the field of archaeology. Please welcome with me Michael Cremo. How are you, Michael?
I'm really great, Brooks. It's really good to hear you again and to be with you and all your listeners.
I am overjoyed, and I'm always honored to have you on the program. Michael and I met face-to-face about 2 years ago at a conference out in San Jose. And the interesting thing, it was actually George Noory who was the one getting the questions, and Michael and I were the ones asking the questions from a microphone out in the audience. And George had never actually met either one of us face-to-face, even though we'd both been on his program numerous times. So Michael steps up to the microphone and introduces himself, and George says, "Oh, my gosh, Michael Cremo." And that was a good exchange. And then I stepped into the mic and said, "Hi, I'm Brooks Agnew." He said, "Oh, my gosh, Brooks Agnew." So That was a great afternoon. I really enjoyed myself. That was a good conference too, don't you think, Michael?
Oh yeah, it was. It was great finally meeting George in person. I'd been on his show so many times. It was really fantastic to meet him in person.
You know, one of the fascinating things that people who are sort of armchair explorers, they of course go to school, high school and college, and we're all told this story. And the more I read of your work, and by the way, Earth Explorers, if you haven't read Forbidden Archaeology or De-Evolution, these are substantial works, and they take an amount of time to get through. It's not like sitting down and reading a novel, but if you could sit down and read and digest this, this is kind of like Discovery Channel on steroids. When you get done with it, you have absolutely no doubt whatsoever in your mind that you have been handed a load of fairy tales your whole life about how long man has been here, where he may have come, and who was in the neighborhood at the time he was living on the earth. And that's what we're going to cover tonight. This is an amazing amount of discovery that you've done, Michael. Are you the only one in the world that compiles all this stuff in this way?
There are some others who have looked at these questions. William Corliss, for example, has put out a few source books that have some of the kind of material that I talk about. But I think I'm the one who's gotten into it most systematically and who's made presentations about this topic at mainstream conferences of archaeology and anthropology. So I would say, yes, there are others who are dealing with this topic. I'm not alone. I'm really grateful that there are others, and I hope there will be more people getting into these topics, because I think it's really important that we have a clear understanding of the questions, who am I, where did I come from, because that has a big impact on our goals. Yeah, you know, that we set for ourselves individually and collectively. If we don't have a proper understanding of our origins, of our place in the cosmos, then we can make some mistakes. And therefore, I'm happy to be part of this research effort about human origins, and I'm happy that there are others who are also approaching, you know, the same question from their perspectives. I think it's something that's very important.
Well, the thing that fascinates me is that archaeology and anthropology fit together so nicely, because in archaeology, it's not the study of rocks. It's the study of basically the thinkings and doings of modern man or mankind, going all the way back to, you know, primitive tool users and hunter-gatherers. And the anthropology is the actual social development and biological, zoological development of the human being, the actual body, the biological transducer we call mankind. The interesting thing is that, you know, when we go back in time, and you told me one time that all of the physical evidence that proves that man is not hundreds of thousands of years old on this earth, but millions of years old, would fit in a wheelbarrow. This stuff we don't really see on display. I think if you're a Discovery Channel addict, you might have seen a snapshot or two. But when it comes to widespread mainstream revelation of this information, especially in the young minds, those in elementary school and junior high and high school that are learning their foundation, learning their place in the universe, this stuff isn't there. Can we just cover maybe for a while why that is? Why is this such a religious thing, even on a scientific level, than it is a true spirit of discovery?
Yes, Brooks. There's a process of knowledge filtration that goes on in the world of science. You know, discoveries that support the current dominant theories will pass through this filter very easily. And that means students in high school or university will read about this evidence in their textbooks. People will hear scientists on television programs, on PBS and the Discovery Channel and National Geographic Channel talking about this evidence. If they go to the local museum, they'll see this kind of evidence. But if there's evidence that radically contradicts the current dominant theories, it tends to get filtered out. It tends to be ignored, suppressed, forgotten, set aside, ridiculed. So most people aren't aware of this evidence which contradicts the current theories. So still, you know, there may be the question, well, but still, why?
Does the ridicule come because of the pride and prestige of the man who first put it in print, or does it come because the pillars of religion are sitting on top of these assumptions, and if the assumptions turned out to be false, the pillars of religion and therefore social man would begin to crumble?
Yes, I think that's true. Most of the mainstream religions have made a pact with the scientists who are now in charge of the scientific establishment. They've more or less made an agreement not to have any kind of positions that contradict what mainstream science is saying about the origin of the human species. We might ask, for example, okay, whether human beings have been here for millions of years, as I'm saying, or whether human beings have been here for about 100,000 or 200,000 years, as mainstream science says, what difference does it make, really? Well, the difference that it makes is that if human beings really have been here for hundreds of millions of years, that means we need new theories of human origins. And those new theories of human origins are going to be quite different than the theories that are now in the textbooks. The textbook theory is that, well, 2 or 3 billion years ago, there was no life anywhere in the universe, certainly not on this planet. But on this planet, there were chemicals in the ocean, and they began to combine together to form some primitive single-celled organisms in the oceans about 2 or 3 billion years ago. And then we're told that some of these single-celled organisms combined together to form multicellular organisms, and that some of them evolved into fish and things like that in the ocean, and then others moved on to the land to become land animals. And some of those land animals, about 40 or 50 million years ago, became the first primitive apes and monkeys, and about 6 million years ago, they became the first primitive ape men, and then about 100,000 or 200,000 years ago, they turned into human beings like us. Now, what's wrong, in my view, about this picture of reality is that it tends to suggest that we are just complex machines made of matter. That's all there is to it. There's nothing higher than that. There's no vital forces or conscious selves. Everything is just complex organizations of matter. And if people accept that, whether they believe in science or religion, most of the mainstream religions accept this theory that human beings evolved from apes, from chemicals, ultimately. There's not too much difference between religionist or materialist or atheist on this point. They all tend to agree on this point that the human body is just a complex machine made of matter. And therefore, when people accept that, they tend to think the main purpose in human life is to produce and consume more and more material things. And that process of producing and consuming more and more material things generates a lot of wealth, and it generates political and religious systems that are designed to control the flow of wealth and power. And it's become very well established, and there's forces in society that take unfair advantage of this whole system. That's the root of our financial crisis that we're in the midst of today.
Well, I mean, if we look at the information that we have right now, we basically only have the last reel in a 100 reel movie. And we're trying to extrapolate what the first and second and third and so on reels look like in the movie. And so we might be able to say, oh yeah, we came forth from amino acids in one cell and then multi-celled and then very specific communities of cells to make complex animals, and then bingo, consciousness came about. And then you might also be able to say, now wait a minute, what is the argument that you can make against the idea that we got here as, you know, fully developed human beings, and we didn't exactly fare so well? I mean, we don't have body hair, we don't have claws, we're not very fast, we can't see at night, we're not very strong, we can't run very far, we can't fight any of the wild animals on our own, not even a groundhog, and survive. But we are very smart, at least some of us are. What is the argument that can effectively be made against the idea that this complex being de-evolved into these other forms, that defects or mutations or splits in the genome through something that was already irreducibly complex became chopped up into pieces and disjointed and actually de-evolved into what we see as Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, and ape man?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point, because all complex structures have a lot of information coded into them, and it really hasn't been shown how complex information can be generated from simple information. It's something that really doesn't happen.
I'm a physicist, and I can tell you that the second law of thermodynamic rules. So what we see are things that, in physics anyway, de-evolve. They go from higher energy states to lower energy states, and there's no getting around it unless you want to put extra energy and intelligence into the system. So what would make anthropologists think that they're special, that things can just organize themselves into more and more complex forms?
Well, because the alternative to that is that you have to accept that there's a higher intelligence in the cosmos, which they're very reluctant to do. And I think that's the root of why there's such resistance to evidence that contradicts, you know, the current dominant theories, because it leads in a direction they absolutely don't want to go in. And also, there's another thing that I think we have to look at. We have to look at the question of what's real in the universe, what actually exists. And today, many scientists will say, and I point this out in my book, Human Devolution. I was pointing out that before we even ask where human beings came from, it's important to understand what a human being or anything else is. So many scientists today are going to say that matter in its various states is the only thing that really exists in the universe, and that if you combine matter, the chemical elements, in a sufficiently complex way in the brain, then you get what we call consciousness and mind and things like that. But only temporarily. If you disorganize the matter, they would say there's no more consciousness, there's no more mind. And I'm proposing that if we really look at all the evidence, we'll see that that's not true, that there are other things that really do have independent existence in the cosmos, and one of them is consciousness. Consciousness has its own independent existence apart from the chemical elements, apart from matter and all its various states. And I think that's a very important thing to understand. It's not a very popular idea today in the world of science. It's practically forbidden to talk about that consciousness existing apart.
I'm surprised that this is really the argument of today. I think the argument in the middle of the field, because at one end we've got physicists like Sir Roger Penrose, who said that consciousness is the result of quantum gravity. And you got me in the middle saying, no, quantum gravity is the result of consciousness. And then you've got very specialized physicists who have been focused on very high-level projects like the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, saying that consciousness is integrally involved in the formation of matter. And in fact, when it comes to the chicken and the egg of physical matter, consciousness is definitely the predecessor.
Well, that's what I would say. I'm kind of in that camp myself, you could say. And that ultimately, that's where we're from, I believe. We're from some level of pure consciousness, and we have devolved into our current position where we're involved with the lower energies. And in this level of reality, we require vehicles that allow us to function here. For example, if I'm a human being, and normally I'm living on the land, that's my normal position. If I go into another element, the realm of water, and I want to exist under the water, then I need a vehicle that's going to allow me to function there, a submarine, a diving suit, something like that. And where does that submarine or diving suit come from? Well, it comes from some engineer who understands that if a human being is going to exist under the water for more than the few seconds that you can hold your breath, that you're going to need a vehicle that will allow you to function on that level of reality. So there are engineers who design and build such vehicles. And I think our human bodies and the other kinds of bodies, plant and animal bodies that we see on this level of reality, are like that. They are vehicles that have been designed, engineered, constructed by higher intelligences in the cosmos to allow conscious selves to function in the level of matter. But that's not our real home. You know, real home is somewhere else. And the main purpose of human life shouldn't be to produce and consume as many material things as possible. It should be to produce and consume as many material things as are really necessary for us to function here, and at the same time allow us to develop our consciousness to the state where it can go back to its original level of reality, which is beyond matter.
Yeah, and we see that in any biological or even mathematical system. When the beings in that system, be they bacteria, rats, or human beings, exhaust the natural resources or take up all the space, or create a situation where the flow of energy, whether it's food, water, or, you know, actual energy for a society, has reached its limit. That is to say, for instance, we look at the state of California. By itself, it's about the 11th largest economy in the world. And right now they're spending $40 million a day in unemployment benefits. And when the employment base is looked at in the state of California, they're actually sitting somewhere around 22% unemployment. These are the people that are, A, looking for work, and they're in the unemployment system. B, people that have exhausted their unemployment and are no longer in the official search for a job, even though they're still looking. And C, people that have accepted part-time work or are contracting, mowing grass, cutting hair, painting houses, fixing cars under the shade tree kind of thing. They're in the system in the sense that they are generating revenue, but they're not in the system in the sense they don't pay taxes and they don't show up on the economic rolls. Now, that would be a real-world symptom of the cause of overpopulating a system's ability to distribute energy to all the beings in that system. And I think, Michael, you'll probably agree with me that mankind has done that either on a village level or a national level or maybe even a global level numerous times. And normally it means that the society is not going to survive in its present form.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it has to do with sustainability of seeing how many resources are there and what manner of life can there be that will allow people to live sustainably within the limits of the resources that are available to them. And I think it is possible to come up with solutions to these things, but as long as you have a worldview that fosters unlimited material production and consumption as the highest value, I think we're going to find ourselves in that situation where we run beyond the limits of our resources, and that leads to environmental degradation. It leads to social conflict. It leads to intense levels of dissatisfaction in individuals psychologically. So there has to be, and this is very difficult to say, but it's a message that comes from practically all the world's great wisdom traditions. There has to be some level of voluntary simplicity. It can't be forced.
It isn't something that can be forced upon you. You know, you look at a population like China, which has been around for a long, long time. Marco Polo, when he was sailing into China for the first time, of course, a great explorer he was, a great record keeper and collector. When he sailed into China, he said, when he returned home, thank God these people are not warlike, because the scope of their architecture, the ability of their engineering, if they were warlike, they could easily take over the world. Now, that race, that ability to consolidate millions, hundreds of millions, and even billions of efforts together into one national purpose for centuries and centuries is what kept China sustainable. But now China is being exposed to the good life via the internet and even television, and they would like to have it now. They have succumbed to Western commercialization, Western commercials, Western propaganda. And although they seem to have gotten a handle on their growth rate, that is to say limiting family size, they don't have a handle on their economic growth. And now they have Chinese society really going after the bounty of the world in a way that they never have in their sociology before. That stress we are now feeling on the planet in a big way. And, if we, like Michael says, continue this race to see who can fill up their garage with the most toys first, we're going to drive ourselves to some kind of of either economic, social, or even a biological cataclysm, don't you think?
I absolutely do, and I think it all starts with the worldview, with the answers to the questions, who am I, where did I come from? If I'm walking around somewhere and I don't know who I am or where I am really, I'm going to get in trouble myself and I'm going to cause trouble to other people. And this is, I think, where the key lies in changing our scientific answers to the questions, who am I and where did I come from? You know, I was in South Africa a couple of years ago. I was speaking at some conferences there. And, you know, I happened to go to a place called Sterkfontein. And that's a World Heritage Site. It's also a place where some fossils, skeletal remains of an ape man called Australopithecus were found early in the 20th century. So it's one of the, you could say, the sacred sites of modern science as far as its studies of human origins go. It's a big tourist destination now in South Africa. There were caves there, limestone caves, where the bones of this ape-man Australopithecus were found. They were about 3.5 million years old. And the place is now a tourist destination. It's a World Heritage Site. And when you go there, before you are allowed to go into the caves, you have to go into a museum where you're more or less indoctrinated in the current scientific theories of human origins. When you walk into this museum at the Sterkfontein caves, which are advertised as being the cradle of humanity, I really don't accept that, because I think there's evidence that human beings like us were existing at the same time as these ape men. I could talk about that later. But as you walk into this museum, there's a big sign saying, discover yourself. And of course, we'd all like to do that. We'd all like to discover ourselves. But when you go in, the answers that are given to this question, who are you, are really extremely materialistic. The very first thing you see is a big quote from the English scientist, Richard Dawkins. And it says, we are robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. In other words, that's what we are as human beings, according to this concept that's being presented, you know, at this place. And it's being presented to students all over the world in their textbooks. It's being presented to the public through all the various media, that what we are is just robot machines. We're robot vehicles made of chemicals. That's what we are. And not only are we robot vehicles made of matter, we're robot vehicles made of matter in competition with each other for survival. And when people absorb that, and religionists have absorbed this idea, others have absorbed this idea, and it tends to generate an extremely, an overly materialistic society that's simply dedicated to producing and consuming more and more material things and destroying the earth while doing it, plus generating lots of conflict and also unequal distribution of wealth. Or I wouldn't say unequal. Distribution of wealth can be unequal, but it's unfairly unequal. And I think that's the root of the financial crisis that the world's now facing, that there are elements within society that are trying to take more than their fair share. They're trying to take advantage of the system.
You know, there are a lot of ways to look at this unfair and fair share. The despondency comes, the disparity comes, because we have a big difference between those that have the wealth and have accumulated the wealth and those that actually generate the wealth. When you look at someone who's worth 10, 20, 30, 40, 80 billion dollars, that person usually sits at the head of, or at least the top pay position of, a string or a tree of thousands and thousands of people upon whose backs that those earnings are made. And when we talk about, you know, the distribution of wealth, the people at the bottom are exchanging what their skill level is perceived to be for a contract or a script that they can then trade anywhere in the world for that fair amount of what the value is of their work. The people at the top of the chain take the profit from those contracts and those scripts of those people who are, quote, less skilled or less educated or, for all intents and purposes, less well-positioned. So it's hard to say, let's just redistribute the wealth to everyone. What has happened in almost every country, in almost every economic walk of life, every industry, is that all the cash has been vacuumed up by fewer and fewer people, and then it's stored risk-free somewhere to earn interest as it's loaned out to other people who don't have the money and need to borrow money to buy buildings and establish roads and pay off national debts, or borrow the money when nations run out of tax revenue, or, you know, the state of California, who's spending $40 million a day on unemployment benefits. That money comes from somewhere. It comes from you all. So what has happened is we have reached the limit of that. And unless the purse strings are unloosed and that cash, that wealth, is allowed to flow through the system again, creating access to capital for those who are going to create more capacity for those people who are unemployed, and right now I'd say it's probably closer to 20% than it is 10%, then we're going to have a social collapse. That's coming. You can bank on it, and it's unavoidable. You cannot keep all the plates spinning in the air on the top of sticks forever. And when they start falling, they're going to fall in a hurry, and we're going to have a real problem. So I don't know if
I think part of what's driving that is the need in the current system for there to be constantly expanding production and consumption. It's just like, you know, as a human being, you could try to constantly eat as much as you can. Ultimately, it's not going to be healthy for you. You're going to be overweight. You're going to become subjected to all kinds of diseases. But the solution isn't to stop eating. It's to eat the right amounts of the right kinds of food to keep yourself in a healthy condition. So I think it's the same with the world economic system. I think there's an optimum level of economic development, which if you go below, there are going to be problems in terms of there not being enough to keep people all over the world in a healthy state. And if there's too much, then that's going to generate problems on the other side. So I think there's an optimum level of economic development. And this means you have to give up the idea of ever-increasing, ever-expanding production and consumption, which is unsustainable. Really, it means setting some limit somehow or other. And I would agree that this can't be imposed. That's why I said there's got to be voluntary simplicity.
Well,
that I think is the ultimate solution.
Yes and no. I mean, the way our system is set up in the United States, only the wealthy have access to capital, whether it's grants or loans or stuff like that. So you're not, what happens is you stop creating an inflow of innovation and disruption and fresh growth. You stop planting saplings, as it were, in business. And pretty soon the entire forest becomes mature and it stops growing. And then what happens is all the light, all the water, all the rain, all the nutrients are soaked up by the large trees, and the small trees are not allowed to get a start. And that's where this country is right now. We, just in the last few years, sent out billions and billions and billions of dollars in grants, but it didn't go to small business. It didn't go to the businesses that have the highest risk, which is what government's there for anyway. If you're going to do these social kinds of injections, they need to be on the small level, on the beginning level, not raked off the top as chips to offset poor business decisions by large corporations, which is what it has been for the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah, another problem that I see is just the artificial nature of the economy. What is real wealth, anyways? Today it's numbers on computers. You know, banks can just generate dollars or yen and different denominations of currencies. You know, I kind of look back to previous times when there was an actual standard of wealth that couldn't just be artificially increased, you know, on a computer. A gold standard, for example. You know, I think that's something that has to be looked at, an actual gold standard. Of course, that's ancient history now, but look where we've gone instead.
The Fed sits down and just adds a couple more zeros magically to its bank account and sells that to banks, who then loan it to us.
Yeah. Of course, I'm interested in these things to the extent that they have to do with, I mean, I see all these things as symptoms of the deeper problem that we've come to just identify ourselves as machines made of matter that have evolved from chemicals. That's what I think is the root of all this, if you trace it back to its actual root. So I think any solution to these questions is going to have to go right back to the root so that we have a proper definition of what a human being is. And I think a human being is a combination of matter, that's part of what a human being is. We have these vehicles, which we call bodies, that are made of chemical elements, that's true. But beyond that, there's a subtle mind element, and beyond that, there is the substance of consciousness, which has its own independent existence. And really, as you were mentioning, some physicists believe that ultimately it's matter is coming from consciousness, not that consciousness is coming from matter. This is, you know, the basic point, you know, I was trying to make in my book, Human Devolution. We haven't evolved up from matter. We've devolved or come down from consciousness. And consciousness is just temporarily covered by matter. Now, if that were the dominant picture of reality, then I think we would organize our societies, our political and economic and religious systems in a different way. If we have this idea that it's matter that's primary and that satisfaction of material needs is the main purpose of human life, the exclusive purpose of human life, then we'll organize our political and economic and religious systems on that basis, which is what we've done.
Yeah, I was going to say that resembles society today.
That's the society we've got today. So I think if we want to change that, it's not enough to just try to fiddle with the symptoms, the political organization, the economic organization. They've got to go right back to the very root perception of the self, these questions of identity, get those right, and then automatically everything else will follow. If you start out with the wrong perceptions of these things, then all of the things that you do based on these mistaken perceptions of what the self really is are going to also be wrong. So I'm interested in all these things, but I follow politics, I follow economics, I follow scientific questions. But to me, it ultimately all goes back to properly identifying the self. Then we can try to decide what is in our self-interest. If we have the wrong concept of what the self is, then we're going to have the wrong concepts of what is of in the best interest of the self. So if we have an overly materialistic definition of the self, which modern science is forcing on us through the monopoly it has in the education system, any alternative ideas are excluded. You can't make any other kind of definition of the self in the education system today. It's forbidden.
Yeah, it's difficult to make those inroads. Let's see if we can take a stab at it, though. We'll take a quick 4-minute break here on X Squared Radio. We'll be back with more Michael Cremo, and we're going to get into where did the self come from, where did the soul, the human body come from, how long have we been here, and where are we going from here. We'll take a quick 4-minute break. I'll be right back with more X Squared Radio right after this.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh it down with good intention. We do.
If you want to be part of X Squared Radio tonight, easy to do. Dial 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. If you just want to listen, take it with you on your cell phone. It's 712-432-0075, access code 318-116. We'd love you to join us either way. My guest tonight is Michael Cremo. We are getting ready to discuss in some depth his book, The Forbidden Archaeologist. This is a compilation of columns that Michael wrote for Atlantis Rising magazine. It's one of the more widely published hard copy magazines out there in the paranormal science. It covers all kinds of things. Interesting reading. Great articles, advertisements. If you want to be part of that, you can always go to AtlantisRising.com and subscribe. They'll send you the magazine each month. Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, last week shot up to number 4 on Amazon.com, pretty close to that on Barnes & Noble. If you want your copy, it's considered by many, at least from the emails that I'm getting, to be quite enlightening in the area of self-help and also in the area of motivational, spiritual, kind of uplifting book. The end of science that most people can get a hold of, like going to the plate with the small end of the bat in your hands. You can get it by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. Click on either the paperback cover or the audiobook. Make sure to pick up the CD by Maureen St. Germain. It'll help you with the meditation in the end of the book. It's a complete package in about 200 pages. You can really figure out how to turn on the law of attraction and make things happen for you in your life. Also, don't forget to get prepared as we go into the fall and winter months. Don't be stranded out there on the road, worried about having to run your engine to keep yourself warm out there. Very dangerous thing to do. Even with modern catalytic converters, you can asphyxiate yourself. Get some supplies by going to 1-800-PREPARE.com. For a few dollars, almost free shipping. And don't forget to put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, in the coupon code, and you'll get an extra 10% off. We provide that as a service to you, and we want you to be prepared in every sense of the word. 40 seconds. We'll be back with Michael Cremo. Don't go away. We're going to find out where humankind came from and just how long we really have been here.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
The question is for this hour, and you're totally invited to call in and participate, is will the real human ancestor please stand up? It's one of the biggest arguments in literally the history of mankind. And it wouldn't be so academic if you considered the ramifications on sociology, religion, and even economics, if you really knew the answer. So, Michael, who is the real human ancestor?
Well, there isn't any real human ancestor because the human form has always existed on Earth. But the human body or any other body is just a vehicle for a conscious self. That's the real self, not the body. And that conscious self has an origin, I believe, on some higher level of the cosmos, a level of pure consciousness. That is what our real origin is. So in that sense, you could say we're all extraterrestrials. We're all from ultimately some other place. And the human body is a vehicle that was designed to allow us to function in the world of matter. It has two purposes. One purpose is to allow us to become more and more deeply involved in the attempts to dominate, control, and exploit matter. That is one purpose of the human vehicle. And the other purpose of the human vehicle is that it can take us back to that higher level of reality from which we ultimately came. And there are different systems of, in the world's ancient wisdom traditions, of yoga, meditation, contemplation, that are meant to help us do that, restore consciousness to its original pure state.
Some would ask the question, if we came from a higher state, and then we dropped into this human biological transducer, as it were. We don't run very fast. We can't see very far. As time goes on, we hear even less. We can't travel the cosmos. We're pretty limited in this body. We can't even interpret a lot of our universe without fancy machines and instruments. And then, you know, the idea is to go through this and then go back home with more experience, or, you know, with the memories of pain and birth and disappointment and love and all of that. Why do we come here in human form?
Well, we're not meant to have come here. It's not necessary that we've come here. The ruling principle on that level of pure consciousness, which I believe is our original home, is love. Love for the source of all conscious beings, love for all other conscious beings. It's a very harmonious condition where there's nothing that is painful. There's no deterioration. There's no birth, no death, no old age, no disease. Consciousness just exists in its pure individual state, and it's characterized by pleasure, knowledge, and existence that are its natural constitutional position. There's no need to strive for knowledge. There's no need to strive for pleasure. There's no need to fear death or non-existence. Existence is just part of nature there, eternal existence. So the only reason that a conscious self would depart from that level is because it becomes selfish. It doesn't want to exist in loving harmony with all other conscious beings and the source of all conscious beings. It wants to be number one itself. It wants to control, dominate, exploit. So that cannot be done there. There has to be some other level of reality where that can go on. And that's the material universe, the realm of matter. There, a conscious self can be as selfish and greedy and exploitative as it desires. And one problem is, however, that this can't be done with the original form of pure consciousness. The original form of pure consciousness cannot do that. Therefore, we're provided with vehicles in which we can't do that. You could say this is like a little bumper car game here, you know, that we've entered into. And the human vehicle, it can be used for two purposes: to increase the efforts to dominate, control, and exploit matter, or it can be used in such a way to just take whatever's necessary and use most of the human energy to get consciousness back to that original state where it's beyond all of this. These things won't even be a memory. The kinds of limitations and disturbances and aggravations and frustrations and horrible things. I mean, you can just look at any newspaper, at any television about the things that can go on at this level of reality as a result of the friction among conscious selves that exist on this level, because they're in competition with each other,
sure,
in their attempts to dominate, control, and exploit. So that is the situation which we find ourselves, but it's not necessary to remain in this position. And we see, basically, there are two types of people in the world. One type of person is becoming more and more involved in the domination, the control, the exploitation of matter in competition with other conscious selves, with everyone trying to come out the winner in the game. And everyone can't be the winner, so there's going to be losers, and it gets to be a very frustrating situation. There are others who see things in a different way, who see, well, we're all beings of pure consciousness. We're all coming from the same source. We're all part of the same family in that sense. There's no need for us to be competing with each other for control of material resources. We shouldn't be trying to simply overproduce and overconsume more and more material things. We should try to provide the material necessities of life in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible, while putting most of our human energy, most of our consciousness, into restoring consciousness to its original pure state. And this can be done individually. It can also be done collectively. You can try to organize society in such a way as to facilitate this. But there are others who want to go in the other direction. And I think we can all find among our acquaintances and among the people that we know, either personally or through the media, that there are some persons who are going more in the direction of exploitation, domination, control of matter. And there are some who are going more in the direction of understanding, well, we're all in this together. We're all coming from the same source. We should all be trying to go back to that original position of harmony on that higher level of reality.
In other words, work for the greater good, work for the public good. Do you think there's evidence in the archaeological record of societies in the past, small or large, that have gotten close to mastering that, working and living at a higher level, although they are physical, biological beings?
Yeah, there are two ways to know about the past. One is what we can actually find in the record of the rocks, which is not complete. You can't get the complete picture in that way. But there are also historical records left, you know, by these ancient civilizations, and traditions that have been passed down orally, for example, that we can find, for example, in Native American traditions. We can find some indications that people were living sustainably and cooperatively within the limits of the resources that nature was providing, while also giving attention to this higher purpose of human life. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India describe societies that were organized according to those principles, living simply, naturally, within the limits of the resources that the earth actually provides. I think Gandhi once said, there's enough on earth for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. So, yes, I think if we look at many of these ancient civilizations, I'm not saying that they were all like this or that at every moment they were perfect in their realization of this, but it appears there were cultures in the past that had a better approach than the one we do now.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think that there is enough and to spare on the earth, but as I said before, it appears at least the bounty of our social system has been vacuumed up by a very few, and they're not letting it flow through the system
That's what I would say. The root of that is, I think, the selfishness and greed that results from an overly materialistic concept of the self, where we see the purpose in life is to get as much domination and control of material resources as possible in competition with others. And the only thing that moderates it a little bit is the understanding, well, if I take too much, the other people in the system are going to get angry with me and revolt, so I'll throw them a few scraps.
Yeah, we've certainly seen that in the record for sure.
So it's not really a genuine compassion and harmonious understanding that we're all in this together and that there's a way to manage things so that everyone gets what they really need to survive in this world, that their material needs are met. But there's not excess. There's not excess.
Yeah, well, I have heard that very thing at celebrations where, you know, people are wearing the finest clothes and jewelry and sipping on the finest champagne. And I've actually heard people say, I wonder what the poor people are doing tonight. That's a perfect example. You know, in your book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, you quote Warren Weaver, and you know, the thing about Warren that I have read, everything that he's written is like the perfect soundbite that you can read over, and every word is in the right place, it's in perfect clarity, and it stands for all time. He says, in a perfect world, an idea would be born, nourished, developed, and made known to everyone, criticized and perfected and put to good use without the crude fact of financial support ever entering into the process. Seldom, if ever, in the practical world in which we live, does this occur. The influence of money on ideas can be powerful. So he's basically saying those that have the gold make the rules.
Well, that's true. And I wrote that. I was quoting Weaver in the context of the role that great foundations have played in setting the agenda of modern science and leading it down this materialistic path because it's in their interest. You know, the foundations were set up by those who had gotten more than their fair share of wealth, and they wanted to preserve it from being taken by the government and taxes. So they set up foundations that they controlled in which, you know, large amounts of wealth could be stored and kept out of the hands of others. And then this is used in a very systematic way because they understood that if you can control the worldview, which is basically provided today by science. In ages past, it may have been great philosophers who provided the worldview. Who today can name even one philosopher? Anybody? No. I think the last philosopher who had any big social impact was Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, in the 40s and 50s. But who can name the name of a contemporary philosopher today? No one. Or in previous ages, it may have been the religionist, you know, the leaders of religions who set the worldview. But in today's world, it's the scientists who answer the fundamental questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? What is this universe? Where did it come from? All these important questions are answered today in society by scientists. So these foundations, like the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the other foundations, have used their influence, their financial support to universities and scientists to direct the worldview in a way that's favorable for their business interests an industrial interest. They want to see people producing and consuming as much as possible. The whole economic and political system is based on that. If production, GMP, goes down a little bit, there are huge, huge shocks that go through the political and economic system around the world.
Oh, yeah. Obama might as well have a bullhorn out there saying, you know, save our country, go out and charge up your credit card, and let's get this economy moving again.
Yeah. So ever increasing production and consumption is the engine that drives the whole political and economic system. And how do you do that? Well, because if people were thinking, well, I'm a being of pure consciousness, I'm kind of stuck here in the world of matter. Yeah, I should take care of things. I should, but I shouldn't become overly involved in the world of matter. I should live here as simply and naturally as, that would be bad for business.
It would be, but it's great for marketing companies. And even in the sense of science, you know, we see fake science all the time. It's just proven in a few years, but that's after those involved have made their money and escaped to the bank. Are there any cases of fake archaeology trying to fit into the status quo or what the leaders of the science have said is the standard? And the facts are not going to distract us from what we have decided. Is there any fake archaeology out there?
Yes, there is. For example, there was the very famous Piltdown Man, for example. It's very important for the whole system for people to think they are just evolved apes, another kind of animal, which is purely material needs. This is very helpful for keeping people in the rat race, just simply working hard to produce and consume more and more material things and generate wealth for people who are extracting wealth from the system, you know, as you were saying, in unfair ways. So to keep people in that rat race, it's important that they think they're rats, that they're simply evolved animals. That's what they are, with purely material needs, purely material functions. So one thing that keeps that idea intact is the theory of evolution as it's currently taught, which is purely materialistic, that human beings are simply evolved apes, that there were apes and monkeys, not exactly like the ones who live in the zoos today, but there were primitive apes and monkeys existing in Africa 40 or 50 million years ago. And some of them got down out of the trees and started walking around on 2 feet. You know, they became the ape men, like Homo habilis and Homo erectus. And so in the early 20th century, scientists were really struggling to find these kinds of missing links between the ape men and the humans. So some of them manufactured a fake missing link that was called Piltdown Man. It was in the textbooks for 50 years. And these fossils of this fake ape man had to have been very carefully stained and treated with chemicals so they would actually look like fossils. I mean, what they did is they took a human skull and they took the jaw of some kind of ape or monkey and made it look millions of years old, and they put it in with a skull so it looked like an ape man.
Wow. And
this was, and in order to do this, somebody would have to have had a high level of scientific training in order to manufacture fake fossils like this. So you do find examples like that. So that's one way in which this fake archaeology manifests. Another way that it manifests is when something is discovered that really contradicts the ape man ancestor theory. For example, if some human bone or human footprint or human artifact that is signifying modern human type beings is found in some very ancient layer of rock, it will be dismissed simply because it contradicts, you know, the theory that we evolved from apes and monkeys. For example, you know, there's a case just a fairly recent case that I wrote a column about in Atlantis Rising, and that's in this current book, The Forbidden Archaeologist. Just a couple of years ago, some scientists in Kenya discovered some footprints, and they said the footprints are exactly like those of modern human beings, but they were found in layers of rock over a million years old. So
how can that be? Well, because we know man didn't exist a million years ago.
Yeah, so they said, well, there must have been some kind of ape man who existed at that time who had feet exactly like modern human feet. And, you know, so that's another way in which this fake archaeology can manifest, or as I call it, you know, it's like forbidden archaeology. If you find something that doesn't fit, well, you have to make it fit, and if you can't make it fit, then it just has to be forgotten. That kind of thing goes on.
So there's never a moment where the professionals, those that are credentialed and have the scientific method is their Bible. There's no moment at which they say, if this fact is true, then we really do have to rethink the way we are publishing the origins of man.
Some do, but then they suffer for that. You know, for example, there's the case of Virginia Steen McIntyre, who's, you know, a geologist. She was a rising star in her profession until she went and dated an archaeological site in Mexico, where some American and Mexican archaeologists had found human artifacts, and they wanted to know how old they were. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues went down there, and they told them, well, these human artifacts are about 250,000 years old. And they were the kind of artifacts that archaeologists say are made only by humans like us, like living humans today, not by any kind of ape man. You know, they require a high level of intelligence. Although they're stone tools, but they still are considered to require human intelligence to make. So when Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues used four different methods to date this archaeological site and came up with an age of about 300,000 years, the archaeologists just said, well, that's impossible because according to their theories, human beings capable of making the artifacts didn't exist anywhere in the world 300,000 years ago. And, you know, they hadn't evolved yet, and what to speak of being present in North America. So they just refused to publish the age for the site. And Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues, they were upset by that, so they decided to independently publish the age for the site. But when they did that, then especially Virginia Steen McIntyre got an extremely negative backlash from her colleagues in the scientific world who started calling her a maverick, a publicity seeker, a troublemaker. And her career in geology was just finished at that point because of this behind-the-scenes campaign that was waged against her for daring to publish something that contradicted the accepted theories and would have meant that the accepted theories had to have been revised.
So this case, two different sciences, that of geology and that of archaeology, rubbed up against each other.
That's right. She said, well, she actually wrote that, well, she just didn't realize how attached these archaeologists were to their theories.
Yeah, they were pretty attached to their ideas, were they?
And that her dating was going to be rejected just because it, you know, contradicted, you know, the theories that they so deeply held. So So sometimes it happens that some scientists, they do stumble upon something that makes them think, well, maybe we have to change our theories, but some of these theories are so much a part of the ideology of modern science that you can't even think of modern. You can tinker a little bit with them within some boundaries, but if you've got something that radically contradicts them and would mean a wholesale revision of the theories, that's another question.
Yeah, but it you know, Michael, it's not onesies, twosies. I spent last summer in Nampa, Idaho, while I was doing some research and development on one of the companies that I'm putting together. And in the local archaeological historical record there is a man figurine that was recovered out of the hills there. And I don't know if, you know, Nampa's kind of a, I don't know, archaeologically, it's fascinating. It's a gorgeous country. But as far as, you know, why people live there, it's kind of beyond me. I don't know what they grow there, but it's pretty desolate. One of the things is that the Snake River goes through this area. And evidently, in ancient times, it was large enough, carving through the rock of this area, and maybe even in glaciers in this area, they uncovered a male figurine 2 million years old. That just didn't fall out of the sky. That was real.
Yeah, that's the Nampa image, and actually that came from a well boring. Yeah, they were drilling an artesian well there, and they were putting down the pipe, down into the ground. That came from about 300 feet below the surface of the ground from a well boring. It was brought up from a depth of about, as I said, 300 feet. And there was a drilling record of all the different layers of rock that the well had to go through until it got down to the level where this figurine was brought up from. And so with that drilling record, we were able to, go to the Geological Survey of the United States and get information about how old the layers of rock were from which this object came. It's definitely a figurine made by humans. It's small, but it's a definite human figure. And as you mentioned, it turned out to be, it come out from a level about 2 million years old. So when this came to the attention of some scientists, it was reported to the scientific world by some scientists, but other scientists very much objected to it. For example, William Holmes, who was an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution, when he heard about this, and his colleague, Alish Hrdlicka, he had a Czech name, but he was an American scientist, they said, well, this is impossible. This couldn't be true. What must have happened? They just invented some story how, well, maybe there was an Indian figurine, and it went through some underground river, and they just wouldn't accept that humans existed 2 million years ago. So this is part of this knowledge filtering process, and that figurine is still in the museum there, the Museum of Natural History, and
Yeah, exactly. I was blown away. If someone would have had the money and the ability to dig down in a large area, down 300 feet, and actually excavate whatever community must have been there to generate that figurine, what if they'd have found a whole village down there 300 feet below the surface in that rock that was 2 million years old?
Yeah. Well, there have been things like that have been found. There's place in Oklahoma called Heavener, Oklahoma, where early in the 20th century, there were coal mines there. And one of the coal miners went down into one of the mines about 2 miles. And he was involved in using dynamite to blast out what they call rooms in the mine at that level.
That sounds really safe.
Yeah, well, you know, mining is dangerous. They just had that thing that happened in Chile. Fortunately, they got them out. But so they would, you know, blast out a section of the mine, and then they would take the coal out. And after they blasted out one section, this miner said that at the end of the tunnel there was a stone wall made of stones that were square, perfectly square, about 6 inches square, and they were very highly polished, almost like a mirror. And it was when he reported that, then the miners were taken out of the mine, the mine was closed, and then the miners were sent to a different location. So the coal in that mine at that level is about 300 million years old. So you've got a lot of stuff like that just nobody really wants to pursue in terms of investigating it.
Unbelievable. What are they afraid of? What is the fear that builds up in these scientific minds that they are, although publicly, I would say, you know, almost like a creed of discovery, and yet when they make a discovery that doesn't fit the current mold into which they are forcing ancient history, they not only reject it, but they bury it and don't tell the people about it.
Well, what they think is they're doing a good job as scientists. They're being responsible scientists is what they think they're doing. Many of them don't believe they're actually suppressing true evidence, which if people knew would cause them to disbelieve in their theories. They don't think like that. They tend to think more like this. Something's got to be wrong with that. I'm not exactly sure what, but it can't possibly be true. So it's as my duty as a scientist is, well, I'm aware of the report, but I'm not going to put it in a textbook. I'm not going to mention it in a textbook. If the object is in my museum, I'm not going to put it on display. So that is more the mentality. You know, they don't think they're suppressing true evidence. They think, we're just being responsible scientists. We're doing our job. This theory of evolution, human evolution that we have, is so well established that anything, any one thing that goes against it must be wrong. So maybe if that happened once or twice, it would be all right. But unfortunately, what's happened is that happens a lot, so that you wind up with a lot of evidence being shoved under the rug. And what I've tried to do.
What are we looking at here? I mean, are we looking at modern man arriving on Earth somehow, either being placed here or flying here on his own from another part of the galaxy or the universe, or traveling through time and going back? Because it doesn't seem like we find a city with 200,000 humans in it. We find a dozen footprints in some volcanic ash and a femur. One human here or five humans there, but we're not finding big populations of human beings. I mean, face it, Michael, we're not built to live in onesies twosies around a planet this size. There's too many predators that like warm-blooded meat, and we're not built to face the elements by ourselves.
Yeah, those are good points. One thing you have to consider is, however, is that things don't last very long in the geological record, especially as you go further and further back in time, less and less is actually preserved. Yeah, there have been some studies in recent years about, and the premise of these studies is what would happen if our human civilization just stopped right now, if human beings just disappeared from the earth today, what would happen to the remains of our huge cities and all the paraphernalia of our huge worldwide modern human civilization? What would happen to it? And the scientists who have done these studies, which have been the subject of scientific studies that have been expressed in books and on television specials on Discovery and National Geographic Channel, is this, that first of all, like a lot of our cities, our population centers are on rivers or oceans. And now we rely on all kinds of flood control systems to keep our cities intact. And if human civilization, human populations disappeared, you know, those dams and levees and flood control systems would break down gradually, and there'd be flooding in these cities that would have a big impact on them. And, of course, we've seen tsunamis. These happen over the course of many thousands of years. There are tsunamis, and there are rising sea levels and things like that that are happening. So one has to consider that. And then we also have to consider that metals will oxidize. That's one thing that happens. So that over the course of a few hundred or a few thousand years, for example, the steel beams that are in the skyscrapers will start to rust ultimately. And when they rust, they expand. And then the concrete and the glass will break off the buildings, and gradually they'll collapse. And you know, if we extend the process over many hundreds of thousands or millions of years, then practically nothing is left. There will be just some rare things that will remain in the geological record. But there are other ways of looking at the past, and that's through the records left by ancient civilizations, which tell large urban populations that have existed on Earth millions of years ago. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak of such things, for example. So,
yeah, well, let's talk about those records just for a minute. You know, the Vedas, the Vedic texts talk about vimanas and ships and things that were used for heavy lifting and fast flying and warfare and even off-planet travel. You've been to Abydos, I'm sure, in Egypt, and seen the one pile.
Well, strangely enough, Egypt is one place I really haven't been to.
Well,
but I know about Abydos.
I'll send you some pictures. But there's a tile in the ceiling right at the entrance of Abydos that really doesn't fit in the temple. It's an anomaly, and I've looked at it very, very closely with telephoto lens and all kinds of lighting conditions. I can tell you it's original. It's not been recarved. It wasn't placed in there after the fact. And it very clearly shows modern aircraft, helicopters, tanks, things like that, carved in it. These aren't hieroglyphs. These are silhouettes, likenesses of modern aircraft. You would think...
I've seen those.
with those kinds of materials, titanium and a special hardened aluminum, somewhere on this planet, we would have found one of those ships. Something, a motor, a bolt, a piece of glass, a door hinge, you know, something, some instrument from them. But nothing has been found. Now, one of three things could happen. Either they didn't exist, and they were just a fallacy like Star Trek or Star Wars is today. Two, they did exist, and they used them to leave, and they took all of them with them, assuming they were all in operational condition. Or three, they did exist, and they were all destroyed in warfare or some kind of religious revolt.
That's possible. We also have to consider the fact, again, that metals oxidize. You know, that's one problem. And then the other problem is nobody's really looking for these things. Today, when scientists want to go looking for something, they have to make a request, you know, a grant request, and they have to state, you know, how this fits in to the whole scientific program. Yes, I want to go to Africa. I want to go to this specific location. I want, you know, a grant of $2 million or $5 million to look for what? You know, if you wrote a grant saying I'm going to look for titanium remains of ancient Egyptian helicopters, you're not going to get that grant.
I would say not.
I've kind of experienced this like a little bit, you know, myself. There's some interesting discoveries that were made in the 19th century in the California gold mines. There in those gold mines, miners were finding human bones, human artifacts, and layers of rock about 50 million years old from the early Eocene period. And these were all collected. These discoveries were collected and documented by J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. He wrote a massive book about them that was published by Harvard University in 1880. And some of the artifacts are still in the collection of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. So it's a very, very interesting case, very, very well documented. So I went out, you know, using Dr. Whitney's old maps, you know, I went out to the Sierra Nevada mountains in the gold mining region and relocated some of the old gold mining tunnels where these objects were originally discovered. And there was an American archaeologist who wrote to me, and he was a little bit open-minded. He wanted to know, is there anything, you know, I could do to help in your research? So I mentioned, well, we could go back into these California gold mines and see what else might be found there. But the process, you know, you can't just do that. These things are on public government-owned land. There's the Bureau of Land Management. They have very strict rules about who can go there and what you can look for in terms of archaeology and things like that. And it just proved to be impossible. And in other countries, I've also experienced that. You know, that years and years ago, maybe in the 19th century, you know, you could do this Indiana Jones kind of stuff, where just anybody go out and dig and find some artifacts, and you know that. But that doesn't go on anymore today. All these things are very strictly controlled by governments, and in order to do archaeological work, you have to, you know, make proposals to different government agencies and things like that. And if it's something that doesn't fit into the mainstream ideas, that permission is not going to be given. Maybe you've had some experience like that in Egypt. I'm
It's very tightly controlled in Egypt. They have had outside contractors come in and make discoveries, and promptly they publish. And Zawi Hawass considers that sort of stealing the thunder of Egypt. And so he very tightly controls the Ministry of Antiquities now and does not let Western scientists come in there and make digs without, direct and constant supervision by the Ministry of Antiquities. And when something is found, as recently as this last summer, when that dig was made in between the Sphinx and the Red Bull event that was in front of the pyramids, they went down into 25th or 26th dynasty areas in front of the Sphinx, highly excavated area since I was there in 2008, January of 2008. They have taken away a lot of dirt, dug a shaft down, and they pulled artifacts out, crated them up, and hauled them off. And everybody was like, well, first of all, there's no shaft going on. And then I published 20 photographs, daytime photographs of the shaft with the bags around it, with Western officials standing around it. These were not Egyptians. These were Germans and Americans standing around that shaft in the daytime. They didn't know they were being photographed. And they surely didn't know that this information was going out to the world, but it did. And so the dig was public. And then they said, yes, we're taking artifacts out, we're crating them up and hauling them off, and we will reveal them in our sweet time. That's our way, so live with it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of control over this sort of thing. And even access to things that have been digging up is very carefully controlled. For example, these California gold mine discoveries. A few years ago, there was a television producer named Bill Cote who was making a documentary for NBC called The Mysterious Origins of Man. And he'd gotten a hold of a copy of my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and had wanted to include some of the cases from the book in the documentary he was making for NBC. And I told him about these California gold mine discoveries, and he went to the museum that is still holding some of these objects in their collections, and they just wouldn't give him permission to see them or film them. Even just getting access to some of these things is very, very difficult. There's a lot of stuff that's not displayed to the public. And, of course, you could say, well, of course, any museum can't display everything. They have to have some things in the storerooms. But then they should allow researchers in to see what's there. But sometimes they very strictly control things so that unless you're really knowledgeable about what might be there and how to work through their different bureaucracies in order to get permission to see that, you won't see them.
Right, so, right. We don't want you to draw the wrong conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Now, I have been able to get access to some of these things. That's part of my work. Actually, those California gold mine discoveries, I was able to get access to them because I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress, which is one of the world's largest international organizations of archaeologists. So I was, one year I had proposed doing a paper about these California gold mine discoveries to present at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress. And they had accepted, their academic review committee had accepted my proposal that I present a report about these discoveries. So I was able to go to the director of the museum at the University of California that was holding some of these artifacts in their collection and show that, well, I've, my proposal to report about these things has been accepted by the World Archaeological Congress. So on that basis, you know, they allowed me to have access to some of these artifacts from the California gold mines, which were found in layers of rock about 50 million years old. So I was able to study them and photograph them, but I had to go through a whole process of applying, making a research proposal, but finally I was able to see them. The objects aren't kept in the museum itself. They're kept in a storage building several miles from the museum, so they are still there, and I was able to see them, but average person would not be able to see them.
Right, right. And you wouldn't be able to portray it in such a way that the average person would get to see them.
That's correct. Yeah, I had to make... That's true. That is definitely true. And it's the same thing. You know, I've been able to go to different museums in Europe. For example, in the 19th century, there was a geologist in Portugal named Carlos Ribeiro, and he found human artifacts and layers of rock about 20 million years old in his country in Portugal. And as a professional geologist, he said they could not have come from some more higher recent level. That's the general counter-explanation. Well, yes, he found them in layers of rock 20 million years old, but they really don't belong there. They fell down to the fissure or something
yeah.
like that.
We don't know how they got there. And yes, all the rock above it was unbroken and unaccessed and uncracked, but they're not supposed to be here anyway.
Right. So, but as a professional geologist, he checked out the situation, said, nope, there's no fissures through which they can come down. They belong in the layers of rock in which they're found. In this case, about 20 million years old. So at the time when he discovered these things, he was an official at the Museum of Geology in Lisbon, in Portugal. So he displayed the artifacts in the museum with labels indicating an age of about 20 million years.
Wow.
Early Miocene, to put it in the proper geological language. And after he died, his colleagues in the museum did something interesting. They left the objects on display in the museum, but they wrote new labels for them.
Oh, my goodness.
Far younger ages of about 20,000 years. They said, 20 million years, that's impossible. We can't have this in our museum. So they just wrote new labels for all of the artifacts. And then the next generation of officials in the museum in the 1950s or 60s just put the whole collection away, new labels and all. So, but I, having done a lot of research, I kind of knew this whole history. So I went to the museum and I got in contact with the director, and he agreed to let me see them. You know, they're kept in some locked cabinets, so we unlocked the cabinets, and I got them out and was able to study them myself. And then later I went out to the countryside of Portugal and relocated some of the places where Ribeiro actually discovered these things. But you know, these are not things that the average person would be able to see, because you wouldn't even suspect.
Michael, I don't see how you sleep at night. I mean, after you hold these things in your hand and say, yes, I saw them, I handled them, I photographed them, I verify that the strata that they came from, geologically speaking, was this age, and you don't want to go shout it from the highest rooftops? You don't want to get on national television?
Well, I do. I'm shouting it on your show tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
I presented a paper on this at a meeting of the European Association of Archaeologists, which was held in Lisbon, I think the year 2000. So I presented a scientific paper on this topic. And so I do try in every way that I can, within the scientific world, in the universities, to the general public, to get this information out. So, and I'm doing it on your show too. So, well, we
appreciate it, and thousands of listeners are sitting out there intently with their fingernails on the edge of their laptop listening live right now. We are going to encourage them to call in our third hour. Let's take a quick five-minute break, get something cool or warm to drink, depends on where you're at. We'll be back in about 5 minutes with more X-Squared Radio and Michael Cremo, the Forbidden Archaeologist. whether you have an advanced degree or whether you're a Discovery Channel addict like most of us, you have to admit that every once in a while you wonder where we came from, how long we've been here, who placed us here. Did we crawl forth from the primordial ooze, or are we ancestors of some great space-traveling race that came here eons ago? The evidence is out there, Earth explorers, that we have been here for many tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of years. Not cavemen, not hunter-gatherers, modern men, crafters of gold, toolmakers, even shoe wearers, because the footprints have been put in stone and they have been witnessed and they have been photographed. My guest tonight is Michael Cremo. He is the author of Forbidden Archaeology and also De-Evolution, and also this most recent book is a collection of his works in Atlantis Rising magazine. It's called The Forbidden Archaeologist, obviously, at least in my opinion, describing himself. Out there on kind of a one-man crusade to try to bring the truth to you, the Earth explorer, the one who is really out there wondering why, from time to time, entire civilizations, modern civilizations with entire sociologies and economies wiped off the face of the earth, or at least scattered to the point where they're back to rubbing two sticks together to make fire, and slowly but surely building those societies back up to either modern or pre-modern societies. Keep in mind, we were riding horses until about 100 years ago. So before that, we would consider those societies to be primitive, even though they had the wheel and might even have had mighty steam engines. Certainly nobody thought in their lifetime that we would be watching flat screen TV and flying through the sky, least of all traveling to other worlds. Now we're doing it. Now, one day, archaeologists and geologists might look at our existence and say, No, there's no way that they flew mighty aluminum cans through the sky from one city to the other. There's no way that they talked across thin fibers of glass from one side of the planet to the other, least of all bouncing their voices off of some metal thing in space and letting it come back to Earth. Now, that's one thing that you really can't take away. Yes, you could have a tsunami. You could have a glacier. You could have a tornado or a hurricane. You can have sunlight and oxidation. That could wipe things out on the surface of the earth or bury them deep beneath sediments tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years old underneath the surface of the earth. But you can't take away the satellites. Those don't age. Those would still be up there in orbit for millions of years. Artifacts on the moon, artifacts on other planets. Have those been discovered, and have those been put behind the airbrush along with everything else? Let's see where we go with this hour with my guest, Michael Cremo. We'll be back in 40 seconds with the third and final hour of X Squared Radio. Don't forget to tell a friend about us if you're listening to X Squared Radio live. You can also listen as an archive listener. We're coming up on our 1,000th hour of interviews just like this one with Michael Cremo. You can get to it by clicking at the archive subscription button at xsquaredradio.com where you're listening to this, or with bbsradio.com, and you can participate anytime, 24 hours a day. Welcome back to the program, Michael.
Hi, Brooke.
That's a good question. I don't know how I came up with it, but if the artifacts have indeed undergone natural floor sweeping here on this planet, what about extensions out to our neighbors in the solar system? Are there artifacts?
Well, that's, That's really a good point, Brooks. And surprisingly, mainstream archaeologists are beginning to discuss that very question, extraterrestrial archaeology. As I mentioned earlier on the show, I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress, which is one of the world's largest international organizations of archaeologists. And every 4 years, the World Archaeological Congress has a meeting in a different city in the world. And I've been to the last five of these conferences. And in 2006, it was held in the United States in Washington, D.C. And at that conference, there was a whole section of lectures on extraterrestrial archaeology.
Wow.
In other words, archaeologists are starting to think about what we will find in other, when we go to the moon, when we go to Mars, when we start investigating more carefully the near-Earth space zone. And they're beginning to speculate about these things, that exactly what you were suggesting, that perhaps there are probes out there that are either from previously existing Earth civilizations or from civilizations elsewhere in the cosmos. You know, and actually, the United Nations and different nations in the world today are beginning to make treaties about what will happen with these artifacts. Who will they belong to? You know, for example, when we go to the moon and archaeologists go there, and they find, well, for example, things that we've sent up there. You know, we've sent probes up there. Who are they going to belong to? What museum will they go in? But then the archaeologists are also starting to wonder, well, what if we find things? What if we find artifacts that were not sent there by Earth humans, but come from elsewhere in the cosmos or from previously existing civilizations on the Earth and Mars? What are we going to do with those? So these
yes,
things.
Yes, now
are
that's
actually
an intelligent question, and I'm glad that they're considering that. I recently listened to Maslin Othman's statement about what they were going to do. There's still no official UN position, but at least somebody, even if it's a physicist, is talking about it.
Yeah, so there is discussion going on about these things. So I think and just, you know, for example, in terms of archaeology as it's going on now, one new thing that they've gotten into is marine archaeology, looking under water for remains of human civilizations, because they've begun to understand that over the past thousands of years, the sea levels have been rising, which means there are vast areas of the Earth that were once above land that are now underwater, and they're starting to look for, you know, starting to do archaeology in that region. It used to be they were just looking for shipwrecks, but now they're starting to understand that there may be remains of human civilizations on the continental shelves that are now under several hundred feet of water, or in the Black Sea, for example. The Black Sea, you know, was at one time, a lot of it was dry land, and then the Mediterranean Sea broke in through the Bosporus, this narrow channel that goes from, you know, through a little bit of Turkey, you know, from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea. And about 10,000 years ago, the Mediterranean broke through and flooded large areas of the Black Sea. And some people think that may be the origin of biblical flood stories, for example. But so marine archaeology is a growing field. And I think in the future, extraterrestrial archaeology is going to be part of it. And I think you've got a good idea for searching more carefully those areas. of space where, you know, we have our communication satellites up to see what else might be there, either probes or things set up there by previous civilizations on the Earth or from elsewhere in the cosmos. I think that's a very good idea, Brooks.
Well, and you know, here we are considering ourselves modern scientists, across disciplinary teams of geologists and archaeologists and physicists and even paleobiologists and paleobotanists working together. And now we have pretty well funded, pretty well trained, what we call astrobiologists. And admittedly, you know, they're looking for something as small as a virus or a bacteria or a fossil of some kind. But what happens if they find something more complex?
You know, and what? You know, it's written into the laws of NASA that they cannot have anything to do with that sort of thing. It's an actual policy.
I didn't know that.
They can't
so
make
their efforts to explore, they're not allowed to find.
That's right. That is outside of their regime. You know, they can look for bacteria and viruses, but anything beyond that, that my understanding is that's written into their policies that they can't be looking for things like that.
Interesting. So if we go back to the moon and they discover a fossil or a skeleton of something, they're going to receive orders from NASA that say, step away from the coelacanth, don't take any pictures, leave that for another division of another realm of government.
Well, I think this came up because at one point, the government had given some funding for search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And then they decided, no, we're not going to have anything to do
with that. We don't want to search for something we might find
in the future. So that's one possible barrier to... of course, things can be done independently, but I think under the NASA regime, I don't think it would happen.
No, you know, NASA doesn't have a very large budget. When you consider that they've got a $600 million budget, JPL has a separate budget, which is mostly funded by military funding. The X-37B was researched, built, designed, computer tested, tunnel tested, and then they gave up on it. And then the Air Force came in, slipped it into their rapid deployment program, poured an untold amount of money behind it, put unnamed technology in it, and launched it. So, yeah, it's clear that there's another space program that we don't really know about, but that's a whole other program. But the idea you know, that we are exploring space with another division of maybe a multinational government, is one thing. What I have found is that, at least in our modern times, the last 50 years, it's been science fiction that's gone out into the unknown, made that unknown popular, and sure enough, whether we're manifesting it or whether we already knew about it and we prepared society for it and then we released the facts to society, those science fiction ideas come to pass, whether we're going to the bottom of the sea or to the moon or making things very small like nanomachines. And it was all introduced in science fiction first. Well, now what I'm seeing, Michael, the last 10 or 12 years, we have seen a lot of movies come out about not, you know, exploring space, the frontier out there, but civilizations coming here to this world. And it's almost as though the science fiction ideas are being funded or supplied information to prepare society for exactly that.
That's possible, I think. And military funding that is not a lot, but some amount of military funding that's gone into some areas that I talk about in my work, like, you know, paranormal research, for example. That's one big part of my whole area of study, because, you know, when I look at a human being, I can see there's more to a human being than chemicals. There's a subtle mind element with very unusual powers, like remote viewing, for example. And, as I documented in my book, Human Devolution, there's, the government in the 1970s, the American military and government poured millions of dollars into remote viewing, which is something that respectable mainstream science wouldn't touch at all. But, the military and the civilian intelligence agencies got into funding remote viewing, because there were things going on in different countries that they couldn't access with spy satellites or spies on the ground, and they used remote viewers working with the Stanford Research Institute, principally to do intelligence work with these paranormal powers. So that's kind of interesting. I think that's another whole area.
And it's not because they really wanted to. They had to, because some of our enemies of the United States were practicing remote viewing, and they were having success at it. So we had to practice this counterintelligence. In fact, I was talking to one of the authors, my captain, my soul, or something like that. His name escapes me right at the moment, but they had to implement a policy of diplomats not accepting gifts and taking them to their office from foreign countries. They have to turn those gifts in, whether it's a picture frame or an ashtray or some kind of trophy or a vase or something. And if they really wanted it, it would be replicated, and they put the replica in the office, and they put the original in a warehouse. And they say, why would you do that? Why won't you just let me have the original? And the answer, and this is directly from Army counterintelligence, the reason is that object has been linked to a remote viewer in another country, where the remote viewer is not tasked to find out what is this diplomat doing today, what is going on around the vase, what's happening around the ashtray that you gave to this diplomat that's sitting on his desk right now. Remote viewing can be attached to a physical object, that physical object be transported across the planet, placed in another room, and it's as though the remote viewer can see what's going on in that room. And so Army counterintelligence removed the items that were given as gifts, and they were replaced with copies just for that reason. They know it's...
Well, once I met Stephen Schwartz, who was one of the people involved in the American military remote viewing program. And I actually met him at a conference in Montreal. We were both speakers at this conference. And I talk about this in this latest book, The Forbidden Archaeologist. But I was at the conference. I met him, and he was explaining how remote viewing can be used in archaeology, because he was part of some projects. One of them was called the Alexandria Project, or City of Alexandria on the coast of Egypt. And off the coast there are underwater remains. And he and his team had used remote viewing to locate objects underwater that archaeologists hadn't found yet. So that was a pretty interesting project. But what I found interesting is that he said this remote viewing ability is something that we all have. So I went to his workshop at this conference where he was showing that this is something that we all have. There were about 100 of us in this workshop. And he selected 3 people from the workshop to go anywhere they wanted in the city within a 15-minute driving radius. He In other words, these three people are to get in a car, drive for 15 minutes, as much as 15 minutes, wherever they want to go. And he also gave them a video camera and told them to videotape the place where they went, remain there for 15 minutes, and then come back. So while they were gone, the rest of us were given some basic instruction about how to see, because these people who had gone, they were also asked to project mentally the imagery back to the hotel where we were.
Right.
So after 15 minutes, they had gone to wherever they were going to go, then Stephen Schwartz asked us to, okay, clear your minds and just record the imagery that comes into your mind. Don't edit it. Don't criticize it. Don't second guess it. Just record it. Write it down. And he sort of instructed us, just imagine what you see above you, below you, to the right, to the left, in front, back. Just record it. Whatever it is, write it down.
So I thought I'll
be a good sport. I'll go along with it. Because I was convinced they'd gone to a bowling alley or something. But, I just decided I'll go along with this. I'll just write down whatever image, comes into my mind. So the first image that came into my mind was yellow flames and red glass holders or something like that. And so I went through the whole exercise. What do I see when I look up, to the right, to the left, front, back, wrote it all down. And next to me in this group was Rupert Sheldrake, who's another researcher in the alternative science field. But in any case, after some time, the people came back. Stephen Schwartz took their video camera, took the tape out, put it in a player, and on a screen, the first image that came up was candle flames, red glass holders.
I was floored myself.
Even I believe in this stuff. I was amazed that I'd gotten it, So I kind of walked up to Steve. I showed him. I wrote this, red glass, candles, red glass holders. And I'd gotten pretty much the whole description right. And Rupert Sheldrake had pretty much gotten the whole thing, too. And actually, about 60% of the people in the room had gotten, not necessarily the red glass holders, but had gotten the description of where they had gone pretty much right.
That is really 60%. That's really amazing.
And it was this remote viewing is apparently something that we all have, but it's like any sort of talent, musical talent or mathematical talent. It's some people have it more than others. But I thought that was pretty amazing. So,
well, it is, and I don't know how it can effectively be used in archaeology, because eventually, you have to find the artifacts. What is amazing is that, you're walking down the street, apparently, eating cookies and drinking milk, and bam, you find an artifact that's not supposed to be there. It's in a sedimentary layer or a rock or in a mine, and it goes, way back, tens of millions of years. Now you have to start rethinking about the anthropology of modern man, because I don't recall, but I do remember this one detail from the book, where a fairly modern boot print was found in soil that got locked in the same time period as a dinosaur footprint. Now,
there's reports like that, and there's reports from even before the time of the dinosaurs. For example, there was a boot print discovered by a man named William Meister in Antelope Springs in Utah. And he was a fossil collector, so he was out collecting fossils. He had this little geological hammer, this little pointed hammer that he was using to break open pieces of rock. So he broke open one piece of rock, and inside there was a full boot print, shoe print, with a trilobite pressed into the shoe print.
It's
like a little shellfish.
Like you stepped up like a cockroach.
It's a characteristic of the geological period called the Cambrian, which goes back about 550 million years, which is before the time of the dinosaurs. So my co-author of the book Forbidden Archaeology, Richard Thompson, went out and visited William Meister. Both of them are no longer living, but at that, you know, when we were doing the research for Forbidden Archaeology, Richard went out and visited William Meister and took photographs of the print in the rock, and then we did a computer analysis of it, you know, comparing it to, you know, shapes of shoe prints that, you know, you just make in sand, and
matched exactly. Even to the stitching of the sole and you know, the size and shape?
Right. Actually, yeah. Like, if you look at your shoe, you know, you'd find that the heel is worn down in a certain place after you wear the shoe for a little while. And it had that feature as well. The heel was worn down. The imprint showed that the heel was worn down in the appropriate place. So that's over 500 million years old, that. And there are other examples from the time of the dinosaurs, which is a little bit later in time. So that is one category of evidence, footprints, shoe prints, many, many millions of years old, those things had been found. So that is another case like that. And a lot of archaeologists, they tend to, it's making discoveries, there does appear to be like an element of what they call just luck, that on the last day of their excavation, they find something, or they're just walking around, they see a little something that leads them to dig. I think there is kind of a paranormal element to it. And again, you were mentioning that, you know, like Hollywood films, you know, were tending to show a lot of things. Like, one thing that you find very common now is films about paranormal powers.
Sure.
I think there's one out in the theaters now about that. So,
well, I mean, we've seen, you know, magic, and we've seen hypnotists, and of course horror films, you know, made their inroads because they make a tremendous amount of profit, and you don't have to have really famous people in them, especially when everybody's getting eaten or blown away. But the films that are being made now are fairly high budget, you know, 2012, Skyline. There was one out with Nicolas Cage called Knowing, which was about a possible conflagration as part of these end times prophecies. We've had, of course, the somewhat humorous and more high energy one, Independence Day. However, and War of the Worlds remake, we haven't really seen one, not one, where these beings are coming in and they're somewhat benevolent, you know, Pleiadian beings or Arcturian beings that are coming in to help us move away from our nuclear proliferations.
Yeah, I mean, that could be, you know, that could be deliberate. You know, for example, Stephen Hawking, you know, the famous astrophysicist, the one in the wheelchair. You know, he recently made some pronouncement that there's probably extraterrestrial intelligent beings, but they're not friendly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it's don't speak back to them. You know, they may come and treat us like, you know, ants on the sidewalk.
Yeah. So I think just like on Earth, there are all kinds of people. Some more benevolent, some more malevolent. Among, And I think there is extraterrestrial life. I don't think we are alone in the cosmos. So I think there, you could probably find among extraterrestrials both kinds as well. But you mentioned
really giving us the other part of the story. You know, as we go back through the ancient record, the Maya, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, it appears as though we see, even in the Babylonian records going back 5,000 years, it appears that we see off-worlders sitting in a chair teaching people about solar systems, for instance, with 13 planets in it. Well, some would say, well, our solar system used to have 13 planets. I don't think so. I don't think you could just rewrite a whole solar system record to accommodate a Babylonian seal 5,000 years old. But it does make sense that a being would come here from another solar system and say, this is what my solar system looks like. This is an astronomy lesson from my point of view. That makes sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the ancient wisdom traditions say their knowledge came from off-world sources. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's I think it's as credible as remote viewing, except in the sense that we have not been able to run the video of what they're actually seeing. But the description of these off-world places seems to be pretty consistent from civilization to civilization, be they ancient or modern. And I don't think these people are getting together and corroborating their ideas. I think they're independently observing something that's out there, an origin or a destination one.
Yeah, that's what I would say, too. It's as if, say people are looking at a mountain. Somebody's looking at it from the east. Somebody's looking at it from the west, the north, the south. I mean, their descriptions are going to be slightly different, but they're also going to have a common feature to them. It's going to be obvious that they're talking about the same thing. And why is that? It's because they're observing the same thing, maybe from a slightly different perspective.
Yeah.
In my book, Human Devolution, I have a chapter. It's called Cross-Cultural Study of Cosmologies, because I was fascinated about this myself. I looked at about 30 world cultures, from different times, different places, and I looked at their cosmologies. And they all had common features. Some differences, but also many common features. And I was trying to think, well, why are those common features there? And some people might propose, well, it's just the human mind. It comes up with similar fantasies or something. But that, to me, doesn't seem right.
Right.
I tend to think it's because they're approaching something that really exists, but from their slightly different perspectives, depending on their cultures and their locations and the time, that they're making the observations.
Yeah, and so, they got to use motifs and technology with that they're somewhat familiar with, like wheels within wheels, or scorpions with tails that sting and voices that sound like thunder, and they're trying to use things that are in their lexicon of their age of time.
Yeah.
Even 30 years ago, if we were talking in terms of, well, you click on this and drag it over there. What? What do you mean? See, we have words and things in our lexicon now that even my parents would have no clue what we were talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. We tend to express things in terms of metaphors based on things that we're familiar with. So, I was just reading one of the ancient Sanskrit texts today, the Mahabharata.
Uh-huh.
And it's talking about, you know, journeying to other worlds in some type of machine, but they would call them chariots. But they don't appear to be like just any cart with wheels that we would be talking about, because they could travel through different dimensions in these chariots, and the descriptions of them, you know, just don't seem, you know, just
exactly.
like a cart with four wheels on it. That's something
pulled
else.
By a horse, it's, right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
I,
so I think that,
I, you know,
that does play
way.
Into it.
And we have, you know, 12 sets of footprints on the moon. And now, as these astronauts are nearing, you know, the end of their life, they feel that there's no governmental retribution that can be taken against them. And they're stepping into the light and saying, I saw things, both on the way there and while we were there and on the way back. And I'm going to tell about it.
Yeah, I think that's very very important. I've looked at some of those reports from both the American astronauts and the Russian ones, too. They've also, in Russia, astronauts have made similar claims of having seen entities and objects in outer space that really they didn't say too much about, you know, at the time these things were happening.
No, they didn't, because they were super patriots. I mean, they all came out of military programs. They were all decorated. They were all well-trained, both psychologically and technically. And when they got an order, they followed it. And when they were ordered and debriefed, you don't speak about this, you don't even tell your family about this, they followed that order. But now we're in a day and an age, and NASA isn't what it used to be. It's not as well-funded as it used to be, even by the military. And, you know, somewhat like the OSHA, for instance, it just doesn't have the teeth that it used to have. And now these astronauts are celebrities. They've written books. They've authored lectures. They've gone around the world and spoken at universities for decades and decades. And they don't really feel like there's anything the government can do to them, especially if they step out. More than one of them, or maybe even all of the remaining ones, step out and say, yes, it's true.
Yeah, I think it's something that we're going to have to become accustomed to, that we're not alone in the cosmos, that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. We're not just here all by ourselves. I think that's an important change that's coming.
Yes, yeah, I feel that too. I don't really know the nature of the change. Now, from the world religions, they would say, you know, Jesus is getting ready to return, and the wicked will be burned as stubble, and the righteous will be caught up in the clouds and go with Jesus to live with him forever in the heavens. That's the religious point of view. Others, maybe more spiritual and less religious, would say, yeah, we're about to be visited with fire and brimstone, and if we don't get our act together, we're going to be wiped out. And then the more scientific, less dogmatic, would say that we're not alone in the universe. We have been visited always, and evidently those visitations can be maybe not so pleasant from an abduction standpoint, or they can be immensely enlightening, as so many have reported. Their encounters with alien beings or off-world beings have been very enlightening and kind of trying to steer them more toward living within the energy bounds or the ecological bounds of the planet.
Yeah, I think that's true. And of course, there was the film Avatar, which comes from a Sanskrit word, means one who descends, you know, from a higher level. And there can be teachings that come from avatars that are valuable for human society. I'm personally very much convinced of that. And As far as coming catastrophes are concerned, I think that is a feature of reality on this level, that nothing is permanent here. There are periodic catastrophes. Of course, this is just part of science. According to paleontology, you know, life began on Earth 2 or 3 billion years ago, and since that time, there have been 6 major extinction events that have occurred at intervals of several hundred million years. So that's there. It's also there in the ancient Sanskrit writings and the Mayan calendar that there are periodic catastrophes. Personally, I don't see that any one of them is coming anytime really soon, but it does appear to be a feature of life on Earth that there are periodic catastrophes that occur.
And you know, there's one of two things that you can do. I honestly don't think a bunker 10 or 20 feet, you know, in the hill is gonna allow you to survive. If the government is building long tunnels, you know, hundreds of feet under the ground into solid rock and preparing all kinds of supplies so that they can live 2 to 10 to 20 years underground, I don't know that that's going to work either. But clearly, there's only two things that we can do. We either go off planet and watch it happen, or we go inside the planet. That's really the only two choices that we have.
Yeah, I think those are two choices. I think there's an additional choice is to just go back to that level of pure consciousness where none of this happens.
Ah, right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That we choose a new future.
So that's the ultimate solution. But if we are here, then yes, it may come down to that, the two options that you suggested.
Well, it would certainly take a lot more resources than any one nation can muster, and it would certainly take a rather rapid and rather wholesale refocus of what is important for modern society. Do we fill up our garages with toys, or do we survive as a race? Interesting stuff. And the fact that the ancients used stone to try to survive these extinction events, even given their blatant and somewhat flamboyant use of engineering.
Yeah, well, one thing is certain, that those pyramids lasted a long time, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And someone said, well, why did they build it the way that they built it? I asked if they've ever been to Fort Sumter. You know, that thing took about 90 days of the worst bombardment of any fort ever in the United States, and not one person was killed inside of it.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so
stone has its merits. Well, on the cover of the book, the Journal of Field Archaeology gave a review. It says, challenging the dominant views of human origins and antiquity. That says it all about this great book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, a compilation of a regular column written in Atlantis Rising magazine by Michael Cremo, my guest tonight. If you feel up to it, and I highly recommend it as maybe even a life accomplishment, get his other two books, Forbidden Archaeology and De-Evolution. Both of these are huge eye-openers. If you came through the public school system or even some of the better private schools, you're going to learn the real story. You're going to learn the real evidence that shows there's a lot more behind the curtain that you were not told. Highly recommend that you pick those book ups. Michael, again, it's been my absolute pleasure to have you on X Squared Radio. Where are you going to be in the next few months?
Well, over the next few months, I'll be sometimes here in Los Angeles doing some publicity for the new book that's out, The Forbidden Archaeologist. I'll also be going up to the Northwest to Seattle and Vancouver to do a few events. If people are interested in that, they could have a look at my website, mcremo.com, which has, you know, schedule of my upcoming events. Then in February, I'll be going to India to do lectures at universities all over India. And that's pretty much my life. A lot of traveling, a lot of research, a lot of writing. I enjoy it very much. And I'll be, if anybody is interested in knowing what my schedule is, you know, they could have a look at that website, mcremo.com.
Right. And 1 year and 4 days from now, on 11-11-11, you're going to be speaking at the Pythagoras Conference in Louisville, Kentucky, right?
Yeah, I'm in touch with the organizers of that, and we're discussing that right now, yes.
Well, I'm going to be there, too. We're going to have – Michael and I have spoken one time on the same venue, as I said, in San Jose. And that was really a record-setting event for Victoria Black, I believe is her last name. Or yeah, maybe it is. She put on that event, and it was like twice as big as any other year that she's had. And it was really a good event. The quality of the speakers, the quality of the venue was really unprecedented for me. And this one in Louisville, and I cannot reveal to you, listeners, where it's going to be in Louisville, but trust me, you set your sights on November 11th, 2011 in Louisville, Kentucky to attend this Pythagoras conference. 20 of the best speakers on the planet in this genre, and it is going to be at one of the finest facilities you have ever seen. So we want to see you there. Well, I will let you go, Michael. It's been an awesome program. I've got about 1 minute over, so I'm kind of out of time, but we've got to get the next host on here after me. Gosh, 3 hours go so fast on this program. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio, and good luck with the new book. It's obviously available everywhere fine books are sold, I'm sure.
Yes, that's right, and there's also a dedicated website for it called ForbiddenArchaeologists.com. So thanks a lot, Brooks. Nice to be with you and all your listeners.
Thank you very much, and give my best to all of yours.
I'll do that.
All right. Good night. There you have it, Earth Explorers, another fine program of X Squared Radio. Thanks for all the chats coming in throughout the program. I know sometimes you don't want to call in. It would be nice if you did every now and then. It's nice to sit out there and just kind of listen to the program because you really never know where it's going to go. We have such fine talent coming on this program, and they bring such great information. We only scratch the surface, so I highly recommend that you pick the book up. It's not very big, and not if you know Michael Cremo's past works, you'll know what I'm talking about. This one you can definitely read in a short amount of time. It's a fun book because, as I said, these are the columns out of Atlantis Rising magazine, so each and every one is a pretty quick read. You'll be amazed how your archaeological skills will improve just by reading this book. Next week we'll be running an archive. We'll pick a best of. I will be in China working on some business, and I will try to give updates to Don, and you never know what will happen. We might do a program by Skype. You just never know. So stay tuned to X Squared Radio, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.